The Education Gadfly Show starts now. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, who hopes Lindsay Lohan gets out of rehab soon, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
Hey, Mike. Man, she looked good in that picture of her going off to rehab, though, I got to say.
Really? I haven't seen her lately. Isn't she all skinny and
she was, out? Like in all the supermarket cover photos from like Skank Weekly or whatever, she looked pretty hideous. But no, in the picture in the Washington Post, she looked good. Glossy hair. Huh. Sparkling eyes.
Hey, you want to look good in rehab, you're going to see lots of other celebrities there. You know,
it's a chance to make friends, line up your next picture.
That's right. It's almost like the Oscars. Well, Rick, it has been a busy week in Washington. The Democrats are making the most out of their first 100 hours in control of Congress. Of course, last week, President Bush announced his plan to surge in Iraq. And, of course, Barack Obama finally threw in his hat into the ring for 2008 Democratic nomination. So the big question is this, Rick. Is America ready for a smoker in the White House?
Obama smokes?
Obama smokes, yeah. I guess he's a,
I did
he's
not
a big
know
smoker.
This.
That's what they say. Yeah.
How much does he smoke?
I don't have that information. But, you know, I think this could create a rift in the Democratic Party as Nancy Pelosi just outlawed smoking.
Banned smoking.
Right? Banned smoking within the Capitol.
So maybe there's a whole Pelosi-Obama thing.
That's right. And where do you think Hillary's going to come
from? I think Pelosi's lining up with Clinton because I suspect Hillary's probably got deep-seated anxieties about cigars nowadays.
Uh-huh.
And so she probably was like, Pelosi, get that stuff out of here.
Very nice. And subtle, Rick. I like that.
Subtle.
That's subtle reference
yes
to the cigar.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's right. It wasn't, you know, kind of hitting people over the head with your jokes like you did last week.
No, no. Well, it's, you know, my new theme for the parts of 07 that after early January are going to be subtle, historically tinged references.
Nice. Well, listeners, if you have something to tell us about politicians' smoking habits or anything else, shoot us a line at letters@edexcellence.net. We would love to hear from you.
Hey, Jen, you just quit smoking, didn't you, again?
Mostly.
So now if Obama wins and smoking's back in, you're going to be totally out of sync.
Oh, no. I'll start again.
Okay.
Out of solidarity.
There you go.
Great. Okay, we're going to start with a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with a real-life education researcher. This is not a fake interview, right? And this isn't just some blogger. Just kidding there, Andrew. Alexander. But this is a real education researcher who actually has substance. Marguerite Rosa.
Whoa.
That's right. A big name.
Whoa.
Talking about her big report from last week on collective bargaining.
This is like
agreements.
When McCain goes on The Daily Show.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And finally, Liam's weird understudy will serve up a dose of education news of the weird. Because as you recall, Liam is off in London this week eating fish and chips.
He is.
Yep. Yep.
Taking his girlfriend to the Tower of London.
That's right.
Showing her the family jewels.
Finally. We waited a whole week for that joke. Good. All right. Well, let's play Pardon the Gadfly, where we debate three topics for 90 seconds each. Jen, kick us off.
All right. Topic one. The news out of New York this morning is that Mayor Bloomberg will push for a major overhaul of the city's public schools. The proposed changes include increasing autonomy for principals, implementing a comprehensive and transparent data system to evaluate schools, and raising the bar for teacher tenure. The mayor's plan also includes a system of weighted student funding. What do you think, Mike? Is Bloomberg's plan everything you could hope for and more?
Everything.
Mike, you look excited, baby.
I am so excited. Woo! This is a great plan. We shouldn't give him, you know, go way too overboard. I mean, when he released this plan, for example, he definitely exaggerated the gains that have been made under his watch in New York City schools. And we've talked before about the problems with the curriculum or lack thereof in New York City. But these structural changes are important and critical. It's all about giving principals some real authority to run their schools, to hire and fire teachers, to have more flexibility in return for accountability. Rick, this sounds right up your alley, Mr. Common Sense School Reform.
I got to say, it's always a little frightening when there's not much to pick at in these things. Yeah, you look at what he's put forward, and, you know, it's like with the Dallas plan we talked about a couple weeks ago, that the proof's always in the pudding. You never know exactly how these things are going to get translated into reality. But boy, you know, for a mayor to stand up and push this kind of stuff and take the political heat that he's already taken, that he's going to take, these are all sensible ideas. I think Bloomberg and Klein are, you know, they deserve kudos for putting the stuff forward and being serious about pushing it.
So, Rick, what do you think? Is this another case for mayoral control? I mean, would we see this kind of action in a city where we had a school board elected democratically? Is it really mayoral control that allows Bloomberg to do this?
I think it's unlikely that you would see a board really, you know, be willing to put, you know, to put the muscle to make these kinds of things happen. You know, there's also downsides to mayoral control, so we shouldn't, you know, over exaggerate. But, you know, if we're talking about, say, the D.C. context, for instance, you know, you would be unlikely to see this stuff if you still had a board driving New York school reform.
Okay, there you have it. Kudos all around for Bloomberg this week. Jen, what's next?
All right, topic two. In a three-part series in this week's Wall Street Journal, the ever-inflammatory Charles Murray claims that, A, about half of all kids are too unintelligent to ever achieve at a high level in school. B, even students of moderate intelligence shouldn't join their truly brilliant peers in college. And C, schools should reinforce the divide between the elites and the other 90% of the population. Rick, do you care to defend your fellow AEI scholar, or are you as shocked by these articles as everyone else?
I don't think Charles would exactly frame it that way. Maybe I read the pieces incorrectly. I mean, I think the notion that he called
Rick,
for reinforcing the divide.
According to Murray, you're probably not smart enough to read his piece.
I think that's a given. But I think we're exaggerating what he said a little bit in this characterization, but the fact is that I think a reasonable read of the Wall Street Journal articles was that there's not much schools can do about improving in the aggregate how much kids know or are able to do. That may not be exactly what Charles meant to say, but I think that's the way it read to certainly me and most people, I think, who've been talking about this. And I don't think that's a constructive or particularly accurate point of view. It's certainly true that schools can't fix all society's problems, that 100% of kids cannot and are not going to succeed by any reasonable demanding measure. But that's a far cry from saying there's not much schools can do about improving what kids know and are able to do.
Well, that's right. I mean, his main argument when people say, but what about all these kids, you know, who start out way behind and made great gains? He says, oh, well, they were just underachieving to start with. Okay. But then you look at the KIPPs and the Amistad Academies, where virtually all of their students are achieving at high levels, and you say, so what? Did they magically find a way to recruit all of the underachieving kids in their respective communities to their schools? And so it was just because of that skimming that they did brilliantly that all their kids are performing. It just doesn't hold up.
Yeah. You know, I actually got an interesting email from Mike Goldstein of the Match School in Boston, who I hope he passes this on to Charles. I'd like to hear Charles' response. He said, look, I'd love to have an analysis. You pick the kids. You tell me whether or not they're underachievers. Put them in the Match School. And Mike said, look, we'll be able to dramatically improve how much these kids know and are able to do in a limited period of time. I would love to hear. I'd love to hear the conversation that unfolded out of that.
Okay. Topic three, Jen.
All right. Final topic. Following a tradition of zany Title IX rulings, New York's High School Athletic Association has ordered female cheerleaders to attend girls' basketball games in addition to their usual duties at boys' games. Both cheerleaders and female athletes have protested the ruling, but administrators aren't budging. They say the cheerleaders must show up regardless of whether the girls' basketball teams wanted and or asked for them. What do you think, Rick? I know you have an opinion on this one.
Dude, more cheerleaders is better. This would be enough to increase attendance at girls' basketball games. All to the good.
So a little personal history here. At the high school that I went to.
You were a cheerleader, weren't you, Mike?
No, I did. I think one Halloween I dressed up as a cheerleader. There is a picture somewhere. But at my school, seriously, we had varsity cheerleaders. We had JV cheerleaders, freshman cheerleaders, wrestling cheerleaders, hockey cheerleaders, as well as the pom-pom squad. So I think if you figure it out, something like 32% of all of the girls in my high school were a part of some sort of cheerleading squad. So one question is at these games, you know, the girls, the cheerleaders are complaining because they have to go to the girls' high school basketball games. They can't then have the time to go to the away games for the boys. Mm. It just seems like you could have more squads.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why not, right?
Absolutely. Participation,
right,
is part of the game.
But another part of this debate is that a lot of people consider cheerleading to be a sport, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, it's not that the girls' basketball team is somehow being given inequitable resources because they don't have cheerleaders, right? It's that if cheerleading is actually a sport, it's actually another opportunity for girls under Title IX, which actually argues for having perhaps boys be cheerleaders at the girls' basketball
games? I think you're complexifying this. To me, the answer is more girl cheerleaders better. So get the girl cheerleaders at the game. Then you're also more likely to get 15-year-old boys showing up for high school women's basketball, which seems to me a win-win all around.
You know, Rick, you always have a way to just cut right to the heart of the matter.
Right through it, baby.
I'm loving it. Okay, that is it for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Rick. Now we turn to this week's interview with education superstar researcher Marguerite Rosa. Let's take a listen. We're here today with Marguerite Rosa, a researcher at the University of Washington Center on Reinventing Public Education. Marguerite, welcome to the Education Gadfly Show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Marguerite, you just came out with a report last week for education sector called Frozen Assets, How Rethinking Teacher Contracts Could Capture $77 billion for School Reform. Tell us just a little bit about some of the major ways that rethinking those contracts could save a lot of money.
Well, the basic premise of the report is that teacher contracts require money to be spent on items that, you know, we say have weak or inconsistent relationship to student learning. The paper identifies eight, and they're things like paying teachers for experience and also scheduling professional development into five full-day blocks instead of having it distributed throughout the year. And then we cost out the things, and we suggest that policymakers should think about the trade-offs and how much money is involved and how that money might be spent differently, not returned to taxpayers, we say. But that just that hard choices need to be made about how money gets used.
And what are some of the other uses that you would use that money for?
We point out that this is the biggest chunk of money is the funds used to pay teachers automatically for each year of experience gained when the research suggests that after 5 years, there's not much of a connection between experience and student performance. But there are other variables around that that could be used with salary, so the money could still be paid to teachers, but hopefully be better connected to student learning. And that might be, you know, bonuses for teaching in difficult teaching posts with more disadvantaged kids, or teaching in subject areas where there's a shortage, or teaching in longer hours a day. Any number of ways that that could happen.
Okay. Now, so this makes sense. So instead of just paying teachers based on the on their experience, the number of years they've survived as a teacher, we're going to try to drive that to incentives to get teachers to teach in the highest need areas and the toughest subjects and to get results for students. That all sounds
right, reasonable.
All right. Well, let's talk about the reaction to the paper, which has been fierce. Let me read you a quote that came from the vice president of the American Federation of Teachers, Antonia Cortese. She said that frozen assets is on thin ice for its sweeping and often inaccurate assertion, The report flunks both economics and research 101 based on a number of misleading generalizations. Are you surprised by the angry reaction that this report got?
Well, I'm not. I mean, I knew it was going to make an uncomfortable point that there's money involved here. And whenever there's money involved and people are looking for new money, there's this question about should we be using that money. So I knew it was going to get a reaction. But I was actually surprised at the nature of the reaction, because the reaction has been, no, it doesn't cost this much. It's shoddy research. The report is peer-reviewed by everybody and their brother. So we dotted every I and crossed every T to make sure that that it wouldn't be characterized this way. But I expected the response to be, yes, these provisions cost money, but it's worth it. Mm-hmm. And so the debate to be more about, you know, what, you know, which trade-off makes more sense.
So the debate's been much more just over the basic question of how much do these provisions cost.
Well, and the goofy thing is that it comes across as though the arguments against the paper are arguing that these provisions don't have costs attached.
Right.
And that's silly. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there are plenty of places in the paper where we say we've gone with a conservative estimate because we just wanted to rely on hard numbers.
Okay. All right, Margaret. So if the Washington Post quoted the superintendent of the Arlington schools, Robert Smith, saying, teachers will not trust our good intentions and will find a system that eliminates the current pay structure and organization to avoid. When you hear folks who are supposedly in leadership positions just refusing to engage with what you're talking about, does it make you tired and just feel like, why the hell are you bothering?
Well, yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that the report points out, and Rick, you've made this point before, that we can't just blame the labor unions. It's every one of these agreements has two signatures on it. It's the school district leadership and the labor union. And you see so many people just shy away from the conversation because it's just not even worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think both parties bear some blame for not having these conversations. I wish that if, you know, the evidence were more routinely put on the table in contract negotiations, you might find things that there was mutual agreement on that were changes from what they do right now.
Well, I don't know what Rick says. I think there's a growing drumbeat about collective bargaining agreement, and this paper is very helpful to raise some of these issues that'll be discussed, and I think you're going to see some movement in at least a few places. That's my optimistic assessment.
I
am a glasses half full kind of guy. Now, Marguerite, thank you so much for coming on the Education Gadfly Show, and I hope you'll consider coming back.
Oh, I will.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Marguerite Rosa from the University of Washington. So, Rick, why do you think the unions are so up in arms about this report?
Because they like the benefits and, you know, I mean, they got at the profession, right? You got at the teaching business in the mid-80s. You were guaranteed that you weren't going to make a ton of money at the start, but you're going to get predictable raises and you're going to get good retirement and health benefits. And you've had efforts to reduce the size of the class you got to teach. And now Marguerite's saying all this stuff ought to be rethought. I think anybody in the teaching business, you know, with 10, 15 years under their belt is going to be frustrated.
You think teachers actually like those benefits, huh?
I suspect.
All right. So this is the latest in a string of reports and conferences just really, you know, attacking collective bargaining in education. I mean, do you think we are seeing some sort of tipping point, or is this just all a lot of hot air?
That's a good question. I don't know.
And was it all caused by the manifesto on collective bargaining that you and Marty West published earlier?
I think that I would safely say no. But no. I mean, I think the thing is to get sufficient awareness that it starts to become possible for state and you know, national political leaders to pick this up, right? To de-electrify this rail in education reform. I don't think it's there. I think it's still too dangerous for most people to wade into this. But I think it's becoming something that it's safer to talk about. And as that happens, I think, you know, you start to open the door to, you know, real reform. So
we'll
see what happens.
Good. And I like that new word, de-electrify.
Deal. Isn't that fun?
De-electric. Dun, 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 dun. I like that.
Nice.
Okay. It is time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird. Filling in for the globe-trotting Liam Julian is Kobe Loop. Kobe, welcome to the show, and what is weird this week?
Mike, as if nerds didn't suffer enough from daily bullying and forfeiture of their lunch money, they're now getting the major slap in the face of being left out of their school's yearbooks. Patrick Agan, a senior at Portsmouth High School in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, simply wanted his classmates to see him draped in medieval chainmail with a giant broadsword slung over his shoulder. But Principal Robert Littlefield ordered the photo out of the yearbook, citing the school's zero-tolerance weapons policy. Agan, a card-carrying member of the Society for Creative Anachronism, which stages reenactments of medieval history, protested that, quote, "I just really like the picture, and it's one of the first good photos I've taken in a long time," end quote.
Poor guy.
Meanwhile, the ACLU has taken on Agan's case, arguing that every student has a right to humiliate himself before his peers. Is this fair, Rick? And who is your favorite medieval theologian?
See, I think Agan is exactly the reason why we need more cheerleaders available at more games. Kid like Agan clearly needs more of that in his life. That's couldn't they do a little Photoshop touch-up on the broadsword, turn it into like a giant dandelion or pixie dust or something so that there was nothing kind of weaponish about it?
I don't know, but if you haven't seen his picture, I mean, oh, we're doing the radio now, but I recommend you going online and Googling.
What's he look
like?
It's
quite a funny picture.
No, no,
you know, typical medieval
soldier.
That's
really not fair. We only reserve that for Rick. Come on. Nerd alert.
A typical medieval soldier? That's because I have no idea.
I mean, I don't think he would have wanted the picture if he didn't have the sword, right? I mean, that was probably the coolest part of the picture.
So are you saying that if you create opportunities for a boy like him to cheerlead, that he will find different interests and hobbies?
You know, I can't speak on his particular case, but I do want to know, Rick, and tell the truth. Did you used to play Dungeons & Dragons?
Yes.
I knew it.
Loved it, man. It was cool because you would be all,
Did you ever dress up in?
Oh, nah.
Like this, no?
Nah. But I remember staying up late and eating like a lot of Twinkies and drinking a lot of Coke, playing right through the night. That was good stuff.
You know what I take away from this week's discussion, though, is that isn't it good to know that our government is busy figuring out whether or not girls' basketball teams need to have cheerleaders at their games, and whether or not a student can dress up in a medieval costume in the yearbook. You know, that to have the federal agencies and courts get involved in these issues is exactly what we need for American education.
Well, we fixed all the major problems in our society. What else do we have to do?
Well, this is true. This is true, and it gives us stuff to talk about. But unfortunately, that time to talk about things is over. We are out of time. That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks for joining us, listeners. Don't forget to read the original Education Gadfly at edexcellence.net. So till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.